Welcome to season 6 of the Not Your Mama's Autism podcast, a podcast about neurodivergence told both through the eyes of our family, the Ollies, and through the lens of the greater global neurodivergent community. I'm Lola Dada Ollie. We hope you enjoy this episode we have lined up for you. So, with that in mind, let's get started. Tim Markle, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Not Your Mama's Autism podcast. Thank you so much, for coming today.
I cannot even tell you how thrilled I am to be on the podcast, Lola. This is just really exciting. I'm kind of geeking out.
So where do we even begin? I mean, there are multiple ways I would love for this to flow. So let's just start where we start. So I want the audience to know a little bit more about you. Tim is the director of the Southern Regional Center for Children and Youth with Special Healthcare Needs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Weissman Center. Tim is an experienced outreach specialist in higher education, specializing in autism, crisis intervention, and developmental disabilities. He's also the proud father of 2 children, including a young man on the autism spectrum named Hunter. He's married, and he's the founder of the Forgiveness Factor, an organization focused on teaching others how to forgive in an unforgiving world.
So, that sounds like me. I like it.
So your layers have layers, Tim. So yeah. You are a systems man. Yes. And by that, I mean you're well-versed in understanding systems, particularly as how they relate to healthcare delivery and social services delivery. So tell us a little bit about how you got to know as much as you got to know within the Madison, Wisconsin metro area.
Well, I had to learn a lot about Wisconsin because I am a transplant from Ohio. And so came here, had to learn all sorts of Wisconsin stuff, had to change my football teams, you know, everything just to fit in. So I'm now a Packers fan, just to make that very clear.
Okay.
But I started the journey, you know, as all parents' journey starts with my son. And when he was born, there was no indication that there was anything that was going to be amiss. The pregnancy was great. My wife was fantastic in pregnancy. She just amazing. And so he was born, and he was my first. And so I didn't have many benchmarks. And so it wasn't until he was about 3 years old that a family friend said, "I'm a little worried about your son." And I look back and I think, how much guts did that take a friend to say? And I love that she did, that she talked to my wife. She talked to me and said, "You know, this is what I do, and I really think that you should consider getting him tested." And so we did, and he started into early childhood. So he had already gone through, he was too old for the birth to 3 program. So we got him into early childhood in our public school system. So that went on a course. At the same time, our lives continue on different courses as well. And I ended up with my wife. We were house parents for a maternity home in Madison. And so we were there with our kids living 5 to 7 days a week, depending on whether we had respite come in or not, with women who were homeless and pregnant and who wanted to keep their babies. And so I learned really quick that we needed to figure out how to connect them to the system and how to get them the support that they needed when they left the Elizabeth House. And so while we were there, we worked a lot on reparenting, teaching them how to parent, helping them care for their kids, but also then reaching out for the support system and connecting to the support system that's out there. When that job ended, the same friend, this is how everything moves in circles in my life, Lola, that same friend who talked to us about my son at 4 years old says, hey, there's an opening at the Waisman Center. I think they could use somebody like you. And so I applied for the job. I ended up getting hired, starting with one grant. And then they've kept me around for going on close to 14 years now, all because life just works together. And so they liked the experience that I was bringing from connecting from the outside of the system in, and said, okay, what we want you to do is we want you to work within the system and get that outreach going for all those families that aren't connected to us yet. So that's what I started doing.
You say it a lot better than I do. When I just say, when there's so many full circle moments like that, I just say, life be lifin'.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. I were still friends with them to the day. They're wonderful people. But it's just, there's some people that come in and they go out and they leave a mark and they leave a lasting memory, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. And then there's these other people that just seem to be entwined. They're just linked to our life, and we get to go through life with them. And that's just, they're one of those couples, and it's just really cool. For a while, my wife was actually there, watched their kids and our kids. And so for a while, our kids grew up together, which is just super cool.
You learned how things are connected, but inherent in that, you also see how things are broken or never quite fully as connected as it could be.
It is so surprising to me every time that I talk to like a state director of a program and they tell me what they think the program does and what it's there for and how it's supposed to work. Because then I have to bring them the bad news that that's a great vision and that may be how it looks on paper, but that's not how it's working in families' lives. And so then we have to have this conversation about where is that breakdown between the support you think you're providing and the actual support that parents are receiving. And so that's sometimes not an easy conversation, but that's why I need to stay connected to the parents, is because we can't have things that look good on paper that aren't working for families.
So how do you start to have those conversations? Like, how do you show them where these gaps are and how they could help without them feeling like it's a personal attack?
First, I make sure that I'm clear with the families about what it is they're experiencing and what they've done, so that I can help them tell their story or tell their story for them if they can't be in the meetings that I'm in. And then it's acknowledging that most of the people in the service system that I've met, not all, but most of the people are there because they want to help, because they want to make a difference. Is you don't, there's other things you could do rather than be part of, you know, one of these waiver programs or long-term support programs. And so I assume good intent and that there's just something that went wrong along the way. So I want them to explain to me how they think their program's working so that I can understand where the families maybe didn't get the help or the support that they should have or could have. And maybe it was a misunderstanding, but maybe it's because someone doesn't understand what they're supposed to be doing. And so there are times where I've had to call someone up and say, look, I talked to this family and then I talked to this case manager somewhere, and this is not what you told me. When we talked about what your program is, that is not what the case manager told the family. So maybe you need to do a refresher course for your case managers and remind them how they're supposed to interact with families. It's a conversation you have to have, because if we don't have that, they never know. And then when you have a decentralized system, then people sometimes aren't held accountable in the way that they should for the way that they treat families.
Along this theme of looking at the gaps, seeing where areas are broken, is there anything in particular on the horizon that you're working on that you're hoping helps to close a gap when it comes to healthcare delivery for children and youth with specialized needs?
Absolutely. is one of the things that I've now been director of the Southern Regional Center for 6 years. And it took me a little while to figure out that we are really, really good at serving the people who contact us. So if you find us, you get through to our information referral support specialist. They are top of the line. You are going to get connected to resources. They will find whatever they can find that is available to you. But you have to know that number. You have to know that web address, and you have to be comfortable reaching out to it. So who were our predominant people? We are really, really good with college-educated white families. They locate us. They understand what we're talking about. And they get served, and it's wonderful. But we're missing huge gaps of people. And so one of the things we had to do is first we had to look inside and say, okay, what is it about our system that may be a barrier in itself? Is it how we ask questions? Is it how we answer the phone? Is it how we give resources? What can we do to make sure that we're not the barrier? And so we continually work on that, on our own racial focal point, I guess could say. What is it that we need to bring into focus so that we can serve all families and not just one set of families? So we looked at that, and then you get a series of failures, Lola. Is I'm like, okay, I've read the books. I know what I'm doing. So I put together a list of organizations that were Black-led. We've got a number of fantastic Black-led organizations in the Madison-Dade County area. They're just super. So I got together this list. I put out a survey and said, look, I'm looking for families of Black people who have children and youth with special health care needs because I want to help them. And I sent this to 15, 20 different organizations. And I got absolutely no responses. Absolutely nobody took the survey. I would go in day by day, every week. I'm like, zero. It's still zero. I'm like, missed the mark on this one. So Talk to some people, talk to some Black families and said, what do I need to do? And they're like, Tim, you need to have somebody that the community recognizes and that the community trusts. And so I'm like, well, how do I find that? What I did was there was a leadership institute held by this organization called the Nehemiah Center for, possibly racial justice or no, community development. And they had a course called Justified Anger, and they offered a leadership institute around justified anger. So I contacted them and said, look, do any of your leaders, do you know if any of them are families? Do they have children with special health care needs in their families? And they're like, geez, that's a good question. We don't really know that. But you know what? We'll email them all and we'll see if we find any for you. And that brought three different phone calls of people that wanted to work together around children, youth with special health care needs. One of those moms we then hired through a contract because we needed somebody who knows the community, who understands families, who understands organizations, and who could sit there and tell us when we're missing the mark. Why people don't know about us, or why people don't feel comfortable contacting us, is we want to know those things. And so that's really been a game changer, because then that formed the basis for, we're crossing our fingers that we'll get a large grant that we can pretty much just make that work so much bigger throughout Madison and Dane County, and really work with those community-based organizations to help them support the families they already have and to help them connect to the system that's already there, as well as working with the families to say, well, how do you want to be connected? What do you need? What resources do you want? So that we can work with them to provide what they need instead of just offering what we have.
So I'm curious, the families, the phone calls you eventually did get and asking people, do they have children with specialized healthcare needs? Were they already diagnosed, or was it a suspicion? Like, what are the stats?
So one of the things, Lola, that is such a good question. So I'll answer that question with another story. We were working with Rock County, which is just south of Madison, and it doesn't have all the financial resources that Madison has because we have the university, we have the seat of state government, a lot of people, a lot of resources. Rock County, not so much. So we worked with the community connector and we're like, hey, we'd like to invite families in who have children with special health care needs and disabilities. And specifically, we're looking for some Black families because we hear from white families. We know them, but we're not hearing from a lot of Black families. And so she's like, okay, I'll see what I can do. And then she comes back with, well, I reached out, but I can't really do it because they don't like to identify their children as disabilities or special health care needs, because then they automatically get put into special education where they're then getting constantly pulled out of the classroom. And then they're usually get put in as behavioral issues and they're not really getting help for any of that. So she's like, so our parents don't use those words. I'm like, wow. Okay. These are the words that the system has. These are the categories the system has. Yeah. Yeah. And so now we're working with Rock County. We're working with our partners down there to find out how parents identify themselves. Because obviously it's hard to form a group and be a part of your group if you don't have a group identity. And so if it's not going to be around disabilities or special health care needs, we're trying to figure out what is the identity of that group. Mm-hmm. Where, how do families view themselves? Because there's a distrust of labels. There's a distrust of having your child labeled if you are Black. And historically, there's a lot of reasons for that.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Definitely.
So we want to figure out how families see themselves so we can figure out how we can get them connected to resources that are there that they're not accessing that could help them.
And it's so difficult because, and so in my situation, for those just listening to this podcast for the first time, and this may be their first episode, I'm the mom of two autistic children, and then I'm also an older sister of an autistic man. So I've walked this journey for about 3 decades or so. And what I watched is, yes, they're sitting at that intersection of race, disability, and in my case too, it was autism and intellectual disability. There are different forms, obviously, but my brother and my daughter are both autistic and intellectual disability. So when you layer race on top of autism, on top of intellectual disability, the concerns are very valid because you're just not sure what affixing that label could do. But in my case too, because I'd watched this over decades, I do know if done well and the proper label is affixed, it can unlock resources. So in my case, the unlocking of resources happened at the Weissman Center. So for those interested, go back to season 1 of Not Your Mama's Autism podcast and we explain in detail. But I'm rare because unlike a lot of the Black parents who are talking through intermediaries, I had my brother as this blueprint background. I was very aware that I had to, it had to be done the right way, but once the label was affixed, and that's exactly what happened. Like once we got the diagnosis, then it was through the Weissman Center that we heard of all these resources, respite, everything we got through Weissman from like a developmental pediatrician through respite center in that Madison metro area.
And that's one of the, what I think is one of the failings of the system of support that we have for people with disabilities and families who have children with disabilities, is that there's so much that's tied to a label instead of just the need.
Yeah.
Is there are families that don't have that autism diagnosis, but yet they have a child that would greatly benefit from the same sort of help and interventions and supports, but they can't access them because they don't have that diagnosis. Sure. And that to me seems to be ridiculous because the kid still has needs. Mm-hmm. The kid still needs help to get up to be equal with his peers. So it's just a weakness of the system.
Yeah, it truly is almost like a key and lock, because that label is how we structured the system to unlock what that person may need down the road. But you're right, it's one of many gaps, one of many, many issues in this space. You're obviously on this podcast for multiple reasons, you know, in your everyday clinical life, what you see, systems delivery that we just discussed. You also made me look at advocacy a little bit differently. We all have different iterations of our lives, I call it. I jokingly say I'm like Lala 4.0, 5.0. There was child Lala, and then there was young adult Lala, and then there was lawyer Lala, then lawyer mommy Lala, and now I'm whatever I am now. So you said something, we met close to 2 years ago now, and you and I were having a conversation. I don't know if you remember this, but you said something along the lines of, which really got me thinking. You said, Lala, I think how you're able to present yourself in the world as you are today might directly be tied to your ability to forgive. And that kind of messed me up, Tim, because I was looking at advocacy, like what you just talked about, the challenges families have. I talked a little bit about the challenges my family had unlocking, getting access to resources. I don't think I've ever articulated how forgiveness is connected to that journey, but it made so much sense. It was very much an aha. I had to sit back and take in what you said, because forgiveness for me was forgiveness of myself and forgiveness of others that disappointed us along this journey that we thought would be walking alongside us. So that dovetails nicely into you being the founder of the Forgiveness Factor. Could you tell us a little bit more about this organization, why you're so passionate about forgiveness and its tie into advocacy?
It does tie into advocacy. It ties into my personal advocacy about my child, but also advocacy about how I now have found a healthier way for myself to live. Because I too spent a long time picturing myself as the problem and picturing myself as broken. And if only I could be fixed, then everything around me would be better. That all these mistakes wouldn't happen and the world would be beautiful and unicorns would be flying. It was just really, I was the fault. And so there was a lot of self-forgiveness that I had to work through to come to a point where I can be real with people, that I don't feel like I'm pretending to be Tim, but I can actually be Tim. And that also then goes through to the advocacy for other people, because along our journey, you know, not every teacher was a fantastic teacher. Is we can look at my son Hunter's, one of his most troubling periods started with a teacher who didn't really want to have a child with special needs in her classroom. Definitely didn't want to have a child with autistic tendencies in her classroom. She thought kids should all act the same and do the same and have the same amount of homework. And there was just something wrong. He just needed to try harder. And this really wore down on him. And we almost look at his life as before that teacher, he really didn't have anxiety. After that teacher, he started to have a lot of anxiety. And so we look at his mental health journey as how that teacher tried to teach and what that teacher's attitude was toward him and toward life. And so he's now, Hunter, just stick your head in.
Hi, Hunter. How are you?
He says he's good, and he heard me talking about his third grade teacher. And he's absolutely correct. I just wasn't going to mention the grade, but that's okay. If anybody wants to try to research all that, you just good luck. That's part of his story, but it's also part of our story.
Yeah.
Because I can look back and just like with my self-doubts, I look at that teacher and say, what if you had been open to the resources that the school was offering us? What if you had been open to treating my son as an individual and not just as part of the group? What if you had cared about his learning as much as you cared about your grading? And it's some of the same things that I look at, you know, Tim, what if you had noticed when he was younger? What if you had gotten help early before he was 4 years old? What if you had been a better dad and been present more? And we just load down what ifs on ourselves and what ifs on other people. What happens sometimes is those what ifs start to turn into anger, and they turn into resentments. And we start to resent those people that we say, well, if you had done better, you're the one. Look, you're the one that screwed up my life. You're the reason for this. Sometimes that's fingers pointing at ourselves, but sometimes it's pointing at somebody else. And we start to feed in that anger, and that builds in our resentment, that builds in our negativity. And then all of a sudden we have trouble finding joy in the world. We have trouble believing that there's goodness out there as we get inundated with the negative, because we live in a world that is bathing us in the negative. It's bathing us in violence. It's bathing us in putting each other down. It's bathing us in power. And these things are not healthy for us. I don't believe that's how we are meant to live. And so my story of forgiveness, my deep down story of forgiveness, is with my dad, who I blame for everything that ever went wrong in my life, and the journey about how I had to learn to forgive him. But it includes learning to forgive those people that I look back and say, well, if you had done your job better. But I can't change that. There is absolutely, no matter how mad I get, no matter how frustrated I am, I can't change what's already happened. So what if I can work through what happened by reframing who that person is, by seeing them as having inherent worth, as being unique and special and irreplaceable in this world, stop making them a monster. In other words, rehumanizing these people who have done wrong. So not ignoring that it hurt, not ignoring they did something wrong, because they did, but that's not who they are in its entirety, is we're all this mixture of good and bad. We all have phenomenal successes and bright lights that shine out from us. And we also have these little tiny stinky closets that we don't want anybody to come in and see. That's true for everybody. And when I started to look at self-forgiveness, Lola, I had to look at the fact that a lot of times my brain would capture other people's highlight reels, and I would look at all the great things that they're doing, but I only seem to be able to look at my blooper reel. When I reviewed what I did, it was all sorts of mistakes and all my missteps, and I couldn't seem to find those good things. Now, some of that is also tied into addiction and the fact that addiction was pulling me away from a lot of those good things. So when I had to learn to self-forgive, I had to learn to start to listen to what I was saying about myself to myself and start to change that inner narrative. I started to see when I was mad and upset at people that I wasn't taking it out on somebody else. I like to say that we are leaky people, that whatever is the emotion that we have inside of us, whatever we have building up on us, that's going to come out of us. And we don't always get to predict when. And so we end up hurting people we don't want to hurt because we're not dealing with the hurt that people gave to us. So forgiveness to me is a way to deal with the hurt that other people or myself have given to me so that I can stop spreading the pain, so I can stop spreading the hurt. So I want to stop those cycles. I want to stop violence. I want to stop anger. And I want to stop those cycles in my life because that's a life I get to control. And so I start there, and then Forgiveness Factor gives me the opportunity to share the work of Dr. Robert Enright out of the International Forgiveness Institute. He's the man his team has been doing research on forgiveness for 30 years and have taken it out of the realm of, oh, well, that's really cute, to, hey, did you know what? It's an evidence-based therapy. People who go through forgiveness have a better quality of life. They have less depression. They have less anxiety. They have less post-traumatic stress symptoms. It's amazing what the science is proving about forgiveness. But I believe that makes sense, because if we begin to live the way that our brains and our bodies and our spirits are meant to be together and on the same page, then we don't have to convince ourselves that we're not angry. We can pretend that we're not angry when our body is all tensed up and our mind is reeling against somebody, but we want to sit there and go, oh no, I'm not angry. Yeah. I look like I'm ready to punch a wall, but I'm going to tell you I'm not angry. It's bringing that wholeness of living together inside myself in a way that I think is a lot more healthy.
Parent guilt. I think mommy guilt is more popular of a term, but parent guilt, my husband and I both had that post-diagnosis, mm-hmm. but particularly me. My daughter was born not breathing, and speaking of the blooper reel in your head, I kept thinking about all the ways I could have changed that narrative. If I had spoken up earlier, what could have happened? Maybe she would be born breathing today. And now we have a mantra in our home that is actually a form of self-forgiveness that we use to guard moving forward in our advocacy for our kids, for just raising them to be the best versions of themselves, whatever that may end up looking like in the future. We look back when we make major life decisions about them. We think, is this the best we can do based on the information we had at the time within the financial and geographic limitations we have? And if we can say yes to those things, we move on. We know we've done the best we could with the information that we had at the time within our limitations, and we keep it moving, because it's just the importance of, like you talk about, tying forgiveness to mental health, forgiveness to advocacy, just forgiveness to self-care is also really important to note on this type of journey. When you know you have a child that has, you know, certain medical needs that you may need to help them deal with for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, all parents will tell you that they never stop being parents. Parents with special health care needs tell me that they realize that at a much younger age than other parents do, is you begin to feel, and you don't want to call it a burden, but you're like, I don't know if I'm ever going to live. I don't know if I'm ever going to be an empty nester. You know, everybody's about this empty. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever going to be an empty nester. And if we dwell on that, then we start to miss out on the cool things that are happening around us, because we start to go back to live in that what if world. And that just, there's nothing, you can't resolve anything in the what if world. There's just no answers for the past, and there's no answers for the future. We got right here. So I'm going to try to live here.
If people want to know more about Forgiveness Factor, how can they do so?
Well, I made it really simple. So if they just go to forgivenessfactor.org, and there you'll see a website. There's not a lot to it, but it does have a lot of links, again, to the International Forgiveness Institute. That's where the research is. That's where those are the people that write books. As I talk about it, as because I will sometimes do speaking engagements for them, is the way that I put it is they get to go to Ireland, and they go over to Israel, and they go to the Philippines, and they go to South Africa. I get to go to Beloit. So, you know, it's like the same thing. Okay. So it's how we even it out here. So they are the ones that are the research foundation for what I do. And I couldn't do anything that I can't do anything that I do without them and the work that they do. And so what my website is basically, I try to introduce people to some audio forgiveness boosts that I do for a local radio station. Every so often I write forgiveness boosts, and I try to link all those there, along with just, I just want people to begin to think that forgiveness is a possibility, because so many people come into the class saying, no, I'm never going to forgive. I just can't forgive. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. You stay here And if at the end of the course you don't want anything to do with forgiveness, I will give you all your anger back. You get all your resentment. You get to feel exactly the same crappy way that you feel right now. You get it all. You don't have to give that up at all. But what if there was a better way? What if there was a different way? What if I could show you a way to finally work through that pain and that anger that you've experienced for your entire life? And in some cases, they stick around. They start to read the books. They start to practice. It takes a lot of practice to forgive. It's not a natural thing. And, you know, as we talked about before, it's certainly nothing that you see the world encouraging you to do. You know, the world's out there saying, get even, get them before they get you, stay on top. And forgiveness is in there going, people make mistakes. People aren't perfect. If you want your inner peace, you have to learn how to forgive other people out there. So it's a different way of trying to look at the world around you. As we talk about how other people are special, unique, and irreplaceable, remember that so are you. Is you have a purpose in this world. There is never, ever going to be anybody like you. You have worth. People don't give you worth. You are born with worth, and nobody can take that worth away from you. Start centering that in who you are, and you're going to go and you're going to do amazing things.
As always, thank you for this. If you like our content, please share and subscribe. If you're curious about how this podcast first came to be, check out season one of this podcast in its entirety on any major podcast platform. If you would like to follow us on social media, please check us out at Not Your Mama's Autism. As always, thank you for your support. Take care and be well.
Not Your Mama's Autism podcast is written and produced by my mom, Lila Dada Ollie, and is occasionally produced by me, Fella Ollie. My dad and sister also contribute sometimes. Big thanks to Anna Lee Ackerman for her audio and video editing support. Until next time, everyone, see you soon.